called River Reflection. Why do you never follow the instructions I give you in ankle at right angle, a look to the left, an extra attention to textbook to microscope? You scatter my pages on all your four wheels. I am honeysuckle and the garlic-scented flower I never recall the name of. I am where I have been. Crack me open, I am a pomegranate that refuses to unfold. I am red, I am raw, open me and I trip onto the floor. I am a bruise that longs to be cut. Break me open with a bite, I give you my permission, but be prepared to bind me together and I am spineless, I have lost my skeleton. I am all fleshy folds, I am an orange pulp. See my four walls unlocked, set out of your rib cage. Make me a reflection, take my dusty pollen placed upon your eyelids, so you'll dream of me, and there I'll be taller, smarter, more beautiful, yada yada yada. Prize me open with a wrench of words to cut through my yellow bushes. Knock all you want, but I've battened down the hatch a long time ago. You'll have to kick it in. There is a window at the top of my tower. Open it now before it closes lazily like a poppy petal over an island, a wave over a line in the sand, a bloom in the twilight. Trip me open. I've been running from the sun such a long time now, feet flailing so fast I've forgotten how to stop. Make me a river reflection. Move your moon face closer to the water. Maybe this time, moon to moon, we'll meet. I'm forgetting that I'm underwater, but lean a little closer and I'll give my lily hand. I'll let down my roots and dark craters of your eyes and throw down my anchor in insurmountable pleasures that lay in your unlocked land. This is called The House of Mirrors. I looked for you in the House of Mirrors. Snatches of childhood truth caught in sidelong glances and dust too indecisive to settle. I looked for me in the House of Mirrors, for the right angles, the right stretching, the right profiles of behaviour. I looked for us in the Hall of Wardrobe, ransacked each cupboard for a place only we could go. I was the white witch, you were the lion, and we ate each other for breakfast. I looked for them in the Hall of Wardrobe, under the bed, inside the laundry basket, greasing of wood furnishings sliding across the floor. I looked for him in the list of characters. He played jester to my throne, and under the strokes of a broken city, he failed to deliver the final blow to me and white tongues of candles flickering in the House of Mirrors. I looked for her in the list of characters, Cinderella still looking for a sliver of glass, occupying herself in the cellar each day, unraveling stitches of a dress she never defined. A glass shoe, well, that would never do, and as it shattered through the past, glass garnishes the House of Mirrors. In a chandelier of shrapnel, silent confetti sprinkled from the sun. And once again, it's you or me, it's us or them. Wardrobes closed in on themselves and mirrors maintain their aspect of indifference. Persephone and Janus fall back into themselves, evaporating from existence. Not a ripple on the surface, not a scratch across the floor.
Thanks, Reed. Next up, for the first time, we have Eldra.
It's called Strength in the Night. Mountain's death, I paid, display, gratitude, and then horror. One seat, oh fuck! The window seat where some oh-so-kind, po-faced pedestrian decides to sit on your aisle seat. Why? What's the point? What do you think is going to happen if you sit by a window? Are you a vampire with high tolerance? With someone shat on it? Surely species have been passed. You wouldn't sit next to it. Offensive smell and all. I shuffle past, although too polite to ask her to move. The seat taken, I ask slightly charmingly. She looks at me like I've shot a gram, but moves beside me, tutting as if I'm the awkward one. I look at the seat. No stain, no dent, no smell. So I shuffle past her so it looks and settle down. She's still pouting, so sour she's breathing lemons. I can feel her breath withering my jacket. The leather is drying out. And she stares. That is until I stare back. Her gaze reassuring forward as if she hadn't been cursing my birth. A short ride home, almost enjoyable, then oh, fuck. I have to ask her to move again. Why didn't she take the spare seat over there? She could have been receptive to her heart's content, assuming she has one. Excuse me. She pulls a face similar to a bulldog chewing a wasp, but moves. I rise, and as once more I squeeze past, she sticks her elbows in my back. I just want to get off. I want to alight home. I want to go and be comfortable after Labor Day toil. I'm off. and before my brain had time to connect with motor function, my thumb is on my nose, fingers crested and waving. We make eye contact as she goes by, and suddenly my tongue is out. For a second we share the same feminine thought. Our souls understand the other for the briefest of moments.
Next up we have Joey O'Neill.
One of the nice things about coming here at once is when you completely unexpectedly hear a poem personally dedicated to you, because as the ex-chairman of a tiny towns committee, I really identify very much with some of the sentiments so eloquently expressed by one of the poems there. But unlike Tarnicus, we never won any prizes, so it didn't last long. Back to the dog road section again. In the woods of Andoli there's many has sworn that the banshee cries lonely in the bleak winter morn. But it's only the vixen as she lies in wait, for in the heart of the winter's wind foxes may. Oh, by the blackthorn and the leaves, there's a vixen in he. A dark fox approaches and the two muzzles me. And a vixen is covered in a sea no less time. In the brown of the black and two red bodies join. There's a colourful pageant by the bridge on Main Street, when the South Union hunt have their annual meet. And the riders, resplendent, sit stately and tall, a Victorian print come alive from the wall. As their custom decrees on each St. Stephen's Day, they march through Kilmore in battle array. They ride up the new road by the old Garrido, for to harry and to hunt down the Mudderaroo. By the bend and the boring the hounds start to bay. The scent is picked up and the fox is away. The horn now rings out in the cold winter sun. Their sporting has started and the hunt has begun. With the hounds leading on, the horses keep pace. They say there's no thrill like the thrill of the chase. The adrenaline surge with the hooves as they pound to the echoing horn and the bay of the hound. Though the fox may have cunning, the hunt is well planned. Every earth and set stops up all over the land. The horses go crashing through bracken and briar, for the master well knows that the fox must soon tire. Their quarry is cornered on the fairy fort hill. The hounds now move in for the ritual kill. From the blackthorn and dooleaf there's a last plaintive cry. Oh, where the dark fox had him mated, now that fox has to die. On the street, in the village, the heart boxes are drawn. While inside in the pub it's all cozy and warm. With hot toddies and brandies and full pints of beer, they toast the best counting for many's the year. By the blackthorn on the leaves the fox has a nurse, and when the blackthorn is blooming and the vixen gives birth, she nuzzles and suckles her newly born young. They'll be grown up next Christmas for the fox hunter's fun. On the day after Christmas the first martyr was slain, and on East Stephen's Day they will kill once again They will ride as per custom by the old galley do. For to harry and to hunt down the mother-a-roo. Oh, tally-ho, and tally-ho, and tally-ray for the day.
Next up, here on the mic, we have Miriam Casey. Miriam there? Disappear? Okay, we don't have Miriam Casey at the mic. We have, for the first time, Liz.
Very small boat. He developed this utopia in the 6 days and then on 7. He spared himself a minute. His majesty, imagine the seducers exhausted as heaven. It's been an eternity that he's left this record of his heaven. Then again, he's a hymn and it's only a man's heaven. Seven.
And now we have a seven mic, Miriam Casey.
And it's a continuation of the story. Here are 3 shillings. Don't ask me where I got them from. Just a trace in the nose and get 1 shilling. That's rough. So time to get down us, refuse to join their plan to get the enemy of world hunted. Hit the villain in his mouth, and you get 2 shillings. That's for your country, for Ireland. All this bloody soft talk about peace and forgiveness. In other words, grovelling at the feet of his treacherous friends, betraying our kinsmen, our brothers, cousins and friends, dishonouring their sacrifices, their love of God and country. I finally hit the frustration of 2 feet with the traitor's eyes, and you get the blame lost. That's for you, MacDonagh. Prove yourself that you're a loyal Irishman, a true patriot, and not a cowardly-based cur, like the treacherous cur there. 55 is blood warming. 3 shillings, you get Lily new doll, a dress, a ribbon for her hair. The lads are right. Brown is a dirty coward. Look at him, afraid to utter a bloody word. Why didn't you let them have it? Shout at them. Swear on his life that he wasn't a traitor, that he'd kill them if he didn't take back such a deadly, dishonourable claim. But no, the fool was silent, eyes far away, allowing them to say and do what they wanted to. But Lazarus was holding the 3 shillings up. The rest were shouting and waving their fists. Go on, MacDonagh, what do you wait for? Get him in the eyes. 3 shillings from his damn treacherous eyes. Christy felt trapped. A desperate black rage surged through his shaking body. A desire to kill. A desire to hurt and hurt and kill. His fist came, went up, his fist first went up the strike. But as he poised to deliver the blow, his lance caught the coin. Glittering silver and sun's ray. With random red tinges. Dark red blood. Christy met Nat's eyes. They were no longer his eyes. They were mysterious eyes. Eyes full of gentle compassion. Deep his pain and deep his love. Christy felt his knees and began to cry. The tears fell relentlessly, loud, bitter tears of sorrow. He couldn't sleep. He felt so strange, cut off inside. He cried for Lily, his brother, his mother, the brother, for O'Flaherty, Brand, most of all, for himself. What was wrong with them all? Which of them were right? When at last his tears subsided and he felt that his head was going to rest, Christy got up. They were gone, the whole blood lot of them. After nearly being the cause of giving him a heart attack, they'd all sneaked off. They were a fine lot and no mistake. Miserably, Christy entered the woods. That man, that stranger, he meant perhaps he could find him. He might be able to ease his country's heart. When he reached the spot, there was no one. Just the ancient elms swaying gently in the breeze. Starfully, Christy put his eyes round the hard and jagged trunk. Why had he thought his flame got out? In this bloody world, there was no light. He should be thinking of his mother. She'd swing from tonight for being so late. Looking down a few feet away, Christy saw them. A clump of the thickest flowers he'd ever seen. Slender stalks of delicate blooms of the palest, purest white lilies of the valley. chuckling gleefully to himself, this was just to pick them up. Murray, as sure as there was a God in heaven, Murray was getting his first lesson in flooring with Flaherty. Murray.
Thanks, Miriam. Next up, could we have Pat Carter?
Well, I'm like Dave Lord or Billy Ramsey, I don't know these poems off by heart. I reckon my head enough to read them on the page, but if I had them in my head, I'd be as head rest as Dave or Billy. So all I got tonight is a four-line poem, and some of you have heard before, Rhymes Ditty. It's a poem that's earning more money than anything else I've written. A four-line poem, I got paid £25 for it 12 years ago. It appeared in a magazine called The Erotic Review. And The Erotic Review seemed to have been edited by us by a bunch of women in their late 30s, early 40s. And it was appeared to be aimed at dirty old men who liked to ease their conscience in consuming erotica by persuading themselves it was intellectual erotica. And I worked in a bookshop at the time, and that's how I discovered it. And I noticed they published a few poems, like in the poem off. So anyway, the poem
is longer than the actual poem.
It is totally longer than the actual poem. We got 6 minutes, I got to fill it somehow. So anyway, I got the check eventually from them, and the payee wasn't The Erotic Review, it was something like the Dynamic Dildo Corporation. I say, look, the fucking bastards, they obviously count on people being too embarrassed bring this to the bank and getting the money out of them. I was actually too penurious at the time to pass it up, so I went into, and of course I couldn't kind of lodge it in an envelope because it was a foreign currency check, so I had to go up to the lodge to a person over at the counter. And for these professionals and people in allied Irish banks, they didn't blink an eye at the Dynamic Dildo Corporation. Of course, we used to deal with Charles Tawhey back then, but anyway. So anyway, it's called Contemporary Catullus on Colour English. I think of all the rubber-tipped pencils I molded gently as a boy, not knowing how long and hard my tongue practiced with joy. And that poem actually made me think tonight that there's a word in the dictionary that's seldom used, langette, and it's to describe anything that resembles a small tongue. Not an actual small tongue, but something that resembles a small tongue. And I think it's a word that deserves to be put into mass circulation, into common coarse parlance.
Yep.
So everybody, go out there and spread the word, langette. All right, thanks.
Thank you, Pat, for that. Next up we have Mr. Billy Randall.
He's done a very famous.
Hi, I just wanted the first half of the poem, and I'll do the second half next week. This is about a guy, because a painter in hospital, an old guy, and actually drawing his own face over and over on the paper while he's in hospital, kind of busy fucking dying, I suppose, and it's a true story. And the guy in question is a very big fan of Rembrandt, the painter. I said I wanted this for Dave because I mentioned Downing Street, which you mentioned as well. You must know, sitting up in the lilac machine light, in the midnight silence of intensive care, as a machine does most of his breathing for him, and he sketches his own face over and over on half-inch thick Remington paper, 2 quid a sheet, he clips to the nurse, and when I'm finished, each page is worth nothing. He pricks ink and smudges it into the paper, grinds pencil at the touch of colored crayon. In that hospital, silence broken by, next door is coughing like brown paper crackling, a lilting giggle from the nurse's station, and the hushing rush of the CPAP machine that pushes air down through its branching trachea, diminishing the VQ mismatch, holding the alveoli open that its claws may not expand again, sending oxygen through the tangled viscous of recirculation to his eyelids, his iris, his clasping finger and tongue that unclasp from the pen he's been clasping as he sees not his own eyes which he just penciled in, but Rembrandt's terrible eyes looking back at him. About suffering, they were never wrong. And he knuckles his forehead as if he'd forgotten something, like the keyless when the door slams shut behind them. Those hazel, light-devouring eyes, from when he paints the old master into the corner of canvas after canvas in his fourth-story studio, till he fourth-story studio, till he fled from their gazes down the down the stairs to Henrietta Street. A terrace of palaces in flaking red brick that in the February dusk accumulating was a trench of dereliction of moist and shadowy Georgiana, and on the breeze a tang of rain. That breeze takes him past the boarded up ground story flat, past two fat barristers waddling on the columns, and the open side door of the King's Inn pub. The row of gleaming taps, the sun-starred curling skin of a regular in the poker machine dimness, past the blue papillonic billow of schoolgirls released from Mount Carmel. Jesus, Paula, he's only a second flat. Now that's deadly. A free gas. Next foot is on the end. The actor has spoken that girl is not flying, but I can't do that.
Riot!
He's a riot! Sorry, I just translated that part of it. Their skirt hits inches up past regulation. I'm telling you, I'm going to cut back again late after school because of you. The breeze floats their washed electric scent after him onto Dominic Street. The building's crisp shadows for a second as the sun breaks through. And there was a spud smell drifting through rain-rotten doorways of the flats on either side of him on that aforementioned rain-forewarning wind. I'll do the second half next week. It only gets better reading.
Thank you, Billy. Next up, we have the first time later, Sharon Ryan.
There was a woman who was teaching me, and she was teaching me about feminism, and she said, I asked her what feminism is, and, because I don't know, and, She said that it is about the female reclaiming agency from the male.
In her opinion, but she was a woman, so, you know.
I don't want to say she was wrong, or, you know. Anyway, before, there is a joke about if a tree, or if a man speaks in a forest and there's no woman there to hear him, is he still wrong? But, anyway, here we are. I'm sitting here watching the girls haul their shop back where I should be. None playing at being horrid, but for every 99 of them that pass, there is one died in the World Cup. The girls who let you drive a 14-wheeler over a crack just to hear the honking. These are the ones who use Rohypnol on themselves before they go. The girl who thinks that all the way means until both of you are dead. You've met them, whether you know it or not. You might even have been seeing one of them and never have known. Here's the clue. After you had sex with her, she grunted and got up and left. She said she had to work or something. She went out looking for a good hard cock. She picked up a wino and she took him to a waste ground and she raped him and she beat him and she bit him and she kicked him and she took his money and she pissed on him and she left him for dead in the field. That is where she went. Your wife could be a tigress looking for the biggest buck ever experienced. And all she got stuck with is a scrabble playing wet fart like you. But don't feel bad for her. She's not hiding her light under a bushel. I can see it. Other guys like me can see it. Bad people see the bad in everyone. We kindle it. When I see it, I capitalize. Beats like that should not be let escape. The secret sign, the devil's horn, and we're leaving together, looking for a hotel, an alley, a car seat, your car seat, whatever. After it's done, she'll shake it off like a daydream that's detained her long enough, straighten her skirt, and return to the world that she's been pretending so carefully to belong to. On her return, she'll kiss you lightly and absently say, hello, and you're saying, hello, I was just talking to Dennis about my ideas for the new carpet. And she'll expertly conceal her disgust, skillfully feign interest. You'll sail off together into the humdrum of your lives as if nothing untoward had ever happened. This is about something. And everything is about something. And this is about something too. It's called Paddy Last. Paddy Last. My family has been fucking and fighting on this land for all eternity. The men telling charming lies to disbelieving bastards who screwed them anyway just for lighting their cigarettes. The women, all Amazonian feminists, testing frying pans, newspapers, vibrators, gouging their meaty thumbs into cheeks, eyes, nostrils, humping lesser men into submission and despair. Blood and strong drink, mist and fog and layers of earth, back to the time of my first mother at the great, lashing out in love and rage at all her selfish children. Now I am drunk, unfaithless. I've orphaned my poorest grandchildren from their rich and crooked heritage. They'll never feel the vial of the earth rise from the core to meet their hands in recognition. I'm going to read one last one, because this is, I'm very sad to take in the apology. This is the last one. I've been reading the papers, as Gaza. I was reading Dick Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, and he says that there's no such thing as God. And reading the papers in the middle of the Holy Land, it's easy to believe that there's no such thing as God. And this is called Dick Dawkins is Right, Inshallah. The dry breeze that wends from the sandstone pages, ink, flavor of figs, the honeyed almond, vast dunes of prophecy and instruction. I have begun to bed the existence of Richard Dawkins. In this warm, eternal desert mist, blood, Lord, force, paradise, fire from the fluorescent light of reason, the flame dances in darkness, coffee and bruise and skillet, far-fetched stories are exchanged, the warm fist of men about to fire, back to turn to the sword. Islam, Alhamdulillah.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin. We're going to do a couple of more people on the other mic on the list. If there's anyone else who'd like to come and say a word, we've got Honest. Give me a shout. This is for the first time. So, next up we have Patricia Walsh.
Well, then you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
This one is called the Cryptic Ship. The artist yearns to be discovered and noticed. Maybe not all the Eternals have been swept mainstream. Maybe he is the last noble savages. The sole survivor of an unsinkable liner on a raggedy Atlantic coast. Standing on the burning deck, he refused to dance, since he wants no part of this world. But listen, the laughter which greeted our compadres is now become our mother tongue. Stalker leads them prisoners from more romantic times. Ha! Well then, never mind. Throw them in with the rest, I don't use them. There's a rope untied. Let the boat sail away like the sunset. As the sun drowns slowly in the quagmire of the twilight, rose-red Judases will walk on the shore and see how the ship looks like crystal, saved to conviction. Nobody here walks plank. No hornpipe commemorates the actually was something. The sad arrival of Roman craft. This one is called Sugar Mix. On the come down from the midfield, pictures in my head begin to fix themselves. Ever deeper by the hatred, my mind has drenched more around. So many people, so many events creep down the stairs of my psyche, circled by the dark times my surprise. I don't really care about the future, the messages a small will bring from the market. Half you require the care and thrills of tomorrow's agenda. Nor do I care about companionship. The one-to-one venture that burns to death. The powerful touch in precious name. Yet for all that, I still consider my wish for my loved ones to serve me. Without effort, they fall away, protesting. There's a lot of crises to solve, you know. Piping from Dublin in when we care. So self-contained with laughter and with joys. It speaks the purpose of the sorrow of a dark age, where terror and tears can only be paramount. Enough of that, as I said. What about it? Repeated injury will not take the weight of sugar and caffeine alone. Enough of that. Now let's shut down the system. We recite the memorial lanes of past glory, the tombs of our loved ones. Forgiveness of flower, in the midst of this, we can't but find something that children get happy to fix. This is called Angel. When did we first know you were an angel? I knew it was 6 and 7, but not until I was 15, when the peacock spread its fan in that bedroom. No one has ever seen that back bedroom. No one has ever gotten in with the noise and suffer. But I took the devil to come to me, and it gets thrown right from my wings. You know these things all your life, when you are cast out to be special and walk the eternal sidelines, from observation point to observation point. I can't see the decay of sobriety, only block takes on. The fake grandfather clock cashed out the hour. Without doubt, I find myself wedged between 200 men, drenched in drunken argument. I do not dare to intervene, because each law is judged by its own kind. I have already minded my own business once I reach the age of 18. Everyone must have wondered what it was like, the hand of a star in your hand, without the benefit of a telescope. They send out the children with fishing nets during meteor showers. My platform in my back bedroom gives me scope to Venus to leap almost to my death, to kiss the moon, embrace the galaxies, dodge the asteroids, and follow my constellation home. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. next up, Mr. Alan Tilley.
Thank you, Paul. A few weeks ago, that was last year, when Ireland was still a rich country, I read part of a long poem about Scotland and Ireland, but I only got it's about 2,000 years long. It took 20 minutes to recite, and I kind of stopped somewhere in the middle, so I'm going to read some more of it, if that's okay. So I think I stopped somewhere, I'm trying to remember where. I think it's to do with the King of England got his head chopped off. However, so I'm going to start with that one along the way. Okay. The greatest king who e'er in England reigned was Charles the First, of whom it could be claimed was full 6 feet tall when he took the throne in 1625, was reduced to 5'6" at the very time he died. But it was his forefathers dumped the hero of Shakespeare's play, Macbeth, Macfinlay, Macrory, Mormaer of Moray, and ushered in a line of craven and rotten Stuarts. Thus the play that bears his name was produced first in court, before James the First of England, but of Scottish James the Sixth, whose purposes then were political, as much as if artistic, and insists again be read more carefully than the bald account of Holinshed. Macbeth then, a Scottish knight as long, who spoke nothing but his own first native Irish tongue, for though neither king spoke Irish down to James the Fourth, it was never again chief language of the court. But when Birnam Wood did come to Dunsinane, the English thing took root, the Irish wanes. The English queen called Margaret, began the rot, with southern ways and customs and lands, grants to solid, reliable burghers of English speech, which pushed that Gaelic language on its long retreat. For this, her good work, Margaret was later canonized. In matters of politics and culture, is God really non-aligned? This then was the first great cultural fissure which religion and politics deepened but did not quite sever. The deep connection, sometimes also merely sentimental wail, between what later writers dubbed the sea-divided Gael. There were times, we must aver, they fully paid us back in cultural exchange, not just the Gaelic origins of the Big Mac, or Scottish whiskey, or post-match seeds of cans of Tennant's lager, or that more recent Glasgow import, Mardvar, dipped in batter. We slipped them too the occasional pig and a poke, like the bagpipes, they haven't yet quite got the joke. There was John Cartwell, the Presbyterian divine, who took responsibility for writing and publishing the very first book ever printed in Irish between solid hard covers, his version of Calvin's Book of Common Order, in Edinburgh in 1567. In its preface he addressed the people of Scotland and of Ireland together and impressed upon them the word of God according to Calvin and their need for instruction in their common tongue being sprung from common seed. For perfectly valid reasons, about 100 years ago, they had occasion to raise his earthly body from the clay and discovered a giant of a man full 7 feet tall, whose body from top to toe had not decayed at all, which only goes to prove, if proof were sought, that those who write in Irish are beloved of God. Or else, or yet, this other seems more right, that what they lack in fame, they gain in height. Though Cartwell's put Dour Calvin's creed in glossy Irish words, the Irish themselves were not reduced, although more ensured, by politics, by distance, by interdynamic strife, than any firmly held beliefs on death, on life. And yet I doubt if we could ever embrace a creed which banished life's laughter from the face, and although we had our share too of po-faced prelates, I doubt if many of them were quite as zealous as that minister in Skye who, to take no chance, banned sex in case it would lead to dance. Language, though, for all its self-set power, cannot escape the weightier crush of matters, both church and state. So when that Scottish James, to whom we did refer, decided that the rebellious subjects, Ulster subjects, would never again threaten the safety of his crown or line, his final solution he with pomp unveiled in 1609. good, solid burghers and land-hungry farmers, he resolved to send across to Ulster and take the Irish from their homes and lands. This policy, with such success, he did pursue, that the killing fields started, we still renew. So when Ewing's kicked out Farrell's, or Lennon's were overrun by Forsyth, or the Nedbets took the castle of Coll MacGillgan, it seemed so distant in the past, so awry and long ago, but the battles fought 4 centuries since is what we still fought now. Scottish civil warfare and Scottish uncivil strife still chew our cud of memory, still demand blood price. For dark deeds done for whatever reason and without regret, in time and kind of Duncan's son and his queen Margaret. So when you are accosted upon the street after another Celtic disaster, and you know full well that those tugs from hell, just that it is thereafter, you know that you're from Rangers too, or at least just anti-Catholic, but you cop on and say, come on, I'm from Cecil Carter. Good answer.
Thank you very much, Anna. We're getting the next part next week, don't we?
Yeah.
Brilliant. So next up, I think we'll go to Phil. Phil.
Yes, Phil.
Yeah. Alan Cody. Alan Cody.
Thank you.
So we next have Mary O'Leary. Mary?
I'm going to have a love affair with life, give up drink for a while, permanently my smile, and I slow down to the underbelly of my being, start feeling, remember my dreams again, feel the body transcend again, my friend. Why do you ask yourself only questions? Answer is always the same. Give up drink for a while. The joy now that I can say, I thought in my heart, I could take him away. Her imminent and father, the folk around Sheila, now Carolina, I'm looking.